Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucknarians? How's it going, man? Women, children, you letting your kids listen to this? How's it going? I'm okay. The quarantine thing is pretty solid. We're dug in over here. I have to start saying we, because there's been an issue that we're going to get into in a minute. Today on the show, I talked to Kathy Valentine, who is a bona fide go-go. I talked to a go-go. And I think people really got to remember just how fucking huge the go-go's were. I mean, they were the first kind of big-ass mainstream, all-on, full-on rock band. Women. All women. And they were the real deal, man. I remember that record. Kathy Valentine, the bass player, who was actually a guitar player before she went into the go, still plays guitar, obviously. She's written a book called All I Ever Wanted. It comes out next Tuesday, March 31st. It's good, a rock and roll story. But, you know, it's also about self-realization, about dealing with, you know, one's parents in the past. I mean, it's just, she lived quite the life because her mom was sort of a free spirit type. Back in the 70s, late 60s. Parents were divorced. I don't know. It was good. It's Texas, Austin, Texas. All the makings of a good memoir. But I'll talk to her about that in a bit. But how are you guys holding up? I mean, it's becoming pretty clear that there's a movement within the government, within the country, that really thinks that money's the most important thing and we should all be willing to lose our grandparents. That, you know, hey, man, adapt or die. We got to keep this thing going. We got to keep selling stuff. We can't have this economy bottom out because then we're going to have no choice but to vote for Bernie. He's the only guy who's going to know how to build it back up. Make the people connect again. If there's no economy, God knows what. Who knows what's going to happen? All I know is that listen to the scientists, listen to the doctors, and if you live in a good state, they're not going to send you out there into the eye of the fucking storm of sickness. This is what they mean. It's going to be state by state. But we'll see. We'll see what happens with this big gamble. Hey, man, you know, who needs old people? We got to keep the, you know, we got to keep the engine going. They're not bringing a lot to the table. It's easier than getting rid of Medicare and Social Security if we just let the old people die. I mean, let's not look a gift horse in the mouth here, people. Come on. That's a point of view happening out there. So, hope you're hanging in there, New York City. Sounds like you're the tip of the spear here in this country that's going to sort of be unfolding in all the cities of the country with any amount of people in them, one after the other, some all at once. My mother's down in Florida. I'm checking in with her pretty frequently. There's no way that's not going to become a shit show of virus. And that fucking governor, he's not doing nothing. Zilch. Zero. Belligerence. in the face of the germ. Hell of a gamble, people's lives, over what? Come on, it's okay to go in the water. Look, the thing is, most of you know that I've been dating this woman, Lynn Shelton, who directs movies. She also directed my last two comedy specials, a couple episodes of Marin, a couple episodes of Glow, but that was before we started doing this thing. Well, she was working on something in Boston. She's living down here in LA now. She's getting her house set up when she went to Boston, but that got canceled. Now she's back here, and she's been in my house, you know, for fucking weeks. But she did have a good point, and I think it's something we all need to talk about. And we'll get to it. But we've been watching a lot of movies. Probably going to get into some comedy tonight. We haven't watched much comedy. Taylor Tomlinson, I'm watching that. And Segura's got one. There's a nice little cluster. I think Taylor's was out earlier, but there was a nice little cluster that I'm happy to be part of. I think I was the first one on Netflix. It's me, Bert Kreischer, who's a friend of mine. I did his podcast recently. I've watched a bit of his special. Segura came out the other day. Me, Kreischer, Segura, and I think there's a D'Elia one coming. I'm not sure. Segura's special is called Ball Hog. Kreischer's is Hey Big Boy. But I know all these guys. I like Tom. I'm going to watch his tonight. I spend my life watching comics, but usually for 15 minutes because I'm not a middle act anymore. So I see everyone for just the right amount of time. 15, 20 minutes. Perfect. Because I'm not a feature act. I have to sit through the headliner. Now, Lynn Shelton is staying with me here at the house. And, you know, we're getting through this together. And she, like, listens to the podcast. Now, I don't understand that. I get it. It's nice. She was a fan before, you know, we started whatever we're doing. But, like, I'll do the podcast. Like, this one comes out today. And by the end of the day, she'll be like, well, that was nice what you said about me. Like, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I'm with you all day long, and now I'm with you, and you're listening to me? I mean, it's a little weird, but I've dealt with it before, but usually not in the same fucking house. So, it's good, though. I'm glad that you like me. What Lynn Shelton is in the room right now, which I can acknowledge, which is part of the problem, because the other day she listened, and she was kind of like, there was something wrong. You know, we haven't been seeing each other that long, but this thing is really, you know, a day is a week. In relationship time and quarantine, one day equals 1 week. So I can tell when there's something wrong. And I'm like, what's going on? So I don't know. See, I'm still talking like you weren't here, which is part of the problem. So what was the problem the other day? Lynn Shelton, the film director of Me. In several different projects. All right, so what happened?
So I you know, have to wait till you're out of the room, or we're in different floors,
yeah,
to listen to your podcast because, yeah, you don't like to hear yourself. So
yeah.
So I think you were downstairs making breakfast, and I was upstairs in the bathroom, and I turned on the... I was taking a bath or something, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I was listening to your intro from Monday, yeah, and... you know, you start out with this nice message about, you know, trying to make sure that to the people about how they should stay connected to each other,
yeah,
and, you know, reach out to people who might be, you know, in need and all,
yeah,
this. And sort of talking, you know, about in general, like what it's like life in under quarantine.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you painted this very detailed portrait of your life,
yeah,
in quarantine. And, you know, the thing is that specific in that particular context, it struck me because I think it's got to be a really different experience to be actually isolated and completely alone.
Right. Right.
And some people are. And
yeah,
I know people who are, and
right,
who are really feeling extra disconnected,
yeah,
from other people.
Uh-huh.
And I'm specifically grateful to have somebody to be going through, you know, with this. Oh my
Who's
God.
Who's that?
He's picking
who are you
up
with?
The hammer. You.
Oh.
I'm with you. And so I just, it particularly struck me because as you were painting this portrait of your life, it just sounded like you were all by yourself.
Is that really true though?
It is. You said I'm stockpiling a lot of food, doing a lot of cooking.
Yeah.
I'm reading, well, I'm not really reading that much, but I am, I'm watching, I saw a great movie last night, Cassavetes, Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
I did do all those things.
You did.
I did.
And I'm spending, a lot of time with my cats.
Did I say that?
Yes. That was how you wrapped it up. And I was like, huh, that is so curious because he just sort of, does he not know I'm here? Like, have I just become so sort of a part of the furniture that he doesn't register
my
presence?
No. This is an interesting conversation because, I have this, I'm who I am on the mics, and all the things I said were true. You were there as well. And I'm not that disassociative, okay? I know that you were there. Uh-huh. I know we cooked the stock. You did the big stock. Mm-hmm. I know that we've been eating food together. We're cooking. We're eating popcorn. We're watching movies. We're both, dealing
chatting
with the cats. We're chatting. We're doing the stuff, the dirty stuff. We're doing, we're having a full life here in quarantine. Too full, even. A lot of time to fill. I'm getting work done out here, but mostly, you're in the house, I'm up here, you're meditating, whatever. The issue is, yes, you're here and I'm experiencing that. Why? The question is, why did I not acknowledge that more thoroughly?
Well, all you need to do is just say we, that's all. An occasional we.
I am my own man. Now I will explain to you what that's about, is I'm in the habit of that. Because, and I really think it is a habit, once I get out here and I get on these mics, this is my experience with my listeners, and I think I am being honest. But the reason that I do that by habit is the last two women I've been with, they didn't want to be part of this. They wanted to have their lives or have some control over how they're depicted, publicly. Over the time, I've gotten into the habit of doing that.
You're right. You can do whatever you want. You're totally not beholden.
I understand why you're upset about it, and I think you're right, and I'll try to integrate it. But I think of it was also me protecting myself against the inevitability of everything being ruined.
Well, I remember if you listen to the arc of your podcast over the years, there was, I believe a time when you were perhaps, where you got an trouble because you revealed too much, right? You would tell a story from a relationship that...
Well, yeah, but anything's too much. But the thing is, it's like, okay, so we're having this thing and it's good and we're having a nice time. And, we both broke up with people and, there's a story, there's backstory, but whatever. But the truth is that the more publicly you live your life here, the more I talk about it, if it goes wrong, if it goes bad, it's a heavy trip. Now, obviously, I'm not going to, people knew about my last relationship, even though it wasn't that. I didn't talk about, about her a lot specifically. I talked about us a bit. But then when it ends, then all of a sudden you got to figure out, well, how do I handle this? And I had to do it very respectfully and not bringing her into it hardly at all. And that's the way that went. So, when we break up, it's going to be a fucking disaster. Because now, look, everyone knows your laugh. Now you're on the show. They know we went through quarantine together. We made soup. And then when it all goes to shit, they're going to be like, is that the one you made soup with during quarantine? Yep. But it sounded like you really liked her when you had her on that time. I know, but things go wrong. Well, what went wrong? What is it that important? Yeah, we all knew her. Everyone knows her.
Your mom will be angry at you.
My mom is like, are you still with her? Yeah. Are you still in love? Yes, everything's going good. She's amazing. How is she doing? How is she putting up with that? How is she still with you? She's really leaning into it too. Like I've been, in the last relationship, she wasn't like that. But now she's sort of like, really? Like, what's with the tone? All right. So, look, were you a Go-Go's fan?
I was a giant Go-Go's fan, yes.
Listen to me segueing like it's a fucking radio show. Because you're in luck. I don't know if you know who Kathy Valentine
really?
Is.
Really? Why?
Kathy Valentine did.
Kathy Valentine?
She's here today.
That's amazing. The bass player from the Go-Go's?
Yeah, she's here today
Holy
on the show
shit.
With you and us.
Wow.
Yeah, just so that's great. You're a Go-Go's
thrilled.
Fan. It's true. You're going to hear me talk to Kathy Valentine shortly, like now. Her memoir is called All I Ever Wanted, which comes out next Tuesday, March 31st, and you can pre-order it now. The Go-Go's documentary premiered at Sundance in January. It will be on Showtime later this year. This is me and Kathy Valentine.
She was lovely. I gave her tea in the kitchen.
We're not co-hosting the show. Right? This is me and Kathy Valentine talking without Lynn here. I enjoyed the book, your whole book.
I'm really happy.
Yeah,
that you did.
I know. I do.
It's a page turner, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't usually do that, and I was curious because usually I'm sort of like, well, what's the angle? You know what I mean? What happened? And you know, I was happy at the end. At the very last two chapters, I'm like, does she get sober? Is this a happy ending? What happens?
Yeah, 31 years.
But yeah, oh wow, I got 20.
It's a good thing.
But you definitely waited till the end to reveal that. You took it right to the edge here.
Well, I knew that I was going to do like an arc.
Yeah.
From 1970 to 1990.
Yeah.
Because I just thought this tells a story. And that was kind of the end of the story. And also getting back everything I'd lost, but getting to do it sober.
Right.
Was like a nice little.
That was the plan. Yeah. So what, but you didn't want to deal with, you like from 1990 to now?
That's another book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there's a sequel coming.
Well, yeah. But first I'm going to do another book or two different ones. So I'm not like just the memoir person.
Right.
So but that'll be in the
so
works.
So writing something that you've taken to and you want to do more of it.
Yeah, I was really surprised like how many female rock memoirs are out there and how many people are into them, but
sure.
But how there's not a lot about music. Like I write a lot about music and how it was a part of
That's
my life.
That's what I love about the book, because we have a lot of the same heroes and you talk to them. I've only talked to a couple, but go ahead.
So I would like to do a book where I just go talk to different women, like instead of like women who rock, like really talk to them about what music was for them.
And
I just feel like that doesn't get talked about a lot. Like we all know what Muddy Waters meant to the Stones and Buddy Holly.
Right.
And I don't think a lot of women get to tell that part of their story. So that's a book I'd like to do.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you definitely tell a little bit of it, but there's moments where I'm a huge Jimmy Vaughn fan, you know?
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
do you like that part I wrote about him?
I love the part about Jimmy, but I also like the part that Stevie comparing him and his brother, where Stevie says when he's playing, he puts everything he's got into it, and when Jimmy's playing, you're only getting about 10% of what he's capable of.
It's so wild.
But it taught you the definition of making choices about your own style
and personality,
right?
Because like that's how Stevie was, and it was so at odds with who he is, you know.
Who, Stevie?
He was so reserved and humble,
right?
And like blazing,
yeah.
But when I would go see the Thunderbirds a whole lot, like when Jimmy would see me out in the audience, because he's known me since I was 16 years old,
right?
He would just like throw in like this crazy like, and just like for me, and I'd be like,
To show you that he could do it.
Well, no, just kind of like recognizing that I was there, and this is for you.
So you weren't born in Austin though.
Yeah.
You were born in Austin, but your old, who was from England? Your mother?
My mom.
Right.
Yeah. My mom was from England, and she ended up in Austin and is still there and still complains about it.
Yeah. But the whole thing, I mean, I can't imagine what Austin was like at that time. I mean, at Texas, because was it cool?
Super cool. It was insanely cool. And I don't know if I would have been a musician if I had been somewhere else.
Right, of course not.
Yeah.
But like I grew up in New Mexico, so I remember what it was like being a teenager towards the tail end of the 70s, but you seem to be like right in the middle of it. And it seemed very exciting to me.
Yeah, the only part I missed out on was like the psychedelic era. Like I didn't see like the 13th floor elevators and
oh, right.
and like Billy Gibbons had the moving sidewalks.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
there was this cool psychedelic era that I was too young for, but sure. everything after that.
Yeah, and also by the time the 70s, right, when you're growing up, everything's just dirty. Yeah. Like, I mean, like the 60s were idealistic, but by the mid-70s, it was just, you know, everybody was just dirty and fucking and doing coke.
But that's what was so great about being a teenager yeah. in the 70s. Yeah. It's like wow, because then you're a kid. For me, I'm a kid in the 60s, so I have that idealism as
right.
a kid.
Yeah, and then a little kid.
Yeah, and then I get to be like this in this debauched era where the worst thing that can happen is you get the clap.
Yeah.
Or
and everyone did, apparently, from
yeah.
what I
oh,
heard.
Yeah.
Like, it was just this common thing.
Yeah.
I missed out on all that. I think.
Well,
there's still time.
Congrats. I don't know.
So, but like the dynamic, what happened with your folks, though? I mean, like, when did they get split up?
I
know some of this, but I don't want to lead you because I read the book. But
yeah. Well, my folks split up when I was three.
Yeah.
And my dad basically just kind of moved away.
I hear that so much. Certain dads, they start over.
I think it was the era, a lot of it. Like
yeah.
this was 1962, and the what he told me later in life was that he said I just figured your mom would marry somebody else, and I'd be in the way, and it was easier for everyone. But it was terrible for me.
Yeah, but that do you believe that?
I don't know, but you know, you got to get people a pass. It's just
sure.
Like,
I mean, eventually,
yeah.
You know what I mean. But that seems like how is he the victim? You know what I mean? Like, oh, shucks. It'd just be easier for you guys if I didn't get, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like...
It was horrible, right?
Well, I didn't really know it was horrible till my 30s, and I wrote about this. It's like I was with a friend, and I was watching her little three-year-old run from her mom to her dad.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it was like this light bulb, like... this kid would notice if the dad wasn't there.
Right.
So I called my mom, and I was like in my 30s. I'd been sober about 5 years. I'm like, hey, mom, what did I do when y'all got a divorce? I'd never asked her in all that time. And she said, oh, it's horrible. You'd sit on the steps and wait for him to come home, and you'd see a car that you thought was his, and it would just drive by, and you would sob. And I was I didn't remember that.
It's part of your heart.
It's in there. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so heavy. Did that make you cry when she told you?
I cried a lot writing this book.
I cried reading the book.
Did you?
Yeah, of course.
I cried doing the audio book a couple weeks ago. There was one part.
Did they leave it in?
I don't know. I don't know what they'll do. But the engineer, the producer was Skyping in from New York. The engineer was in the other room.
Yeah.
And there was one part where we were all just like sobbing.
Oh, God, yeah.
I kind of don't think they should leave it in. That's awkward.
Well, I mean, the parts where you cry are they're not bad cries. You know what I mean? They're not tragic cries. They're actually cries of sort of like connection. And usually it's when I cry, it's when the good things happen or surprising, you know, reconnections or that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
or,
and you're just being moved.
Sure, right. And the getting sober thing, that always gets me.
Yeah.
The kind of realizations that one has, that moment that people... that you know, sort of get it. You know, I get, like, if I'm at a meeting, man, I'm just wired to cry at that moment in those stories where the hand of AA is there.
What do they
call it?
They call it the, what do they call it when, the Eskimo?
Uh-huh.
That like the person that like always like makes you go, oh, maybe I should quit.
Right. Oh, is that what they call them?
Yeah, I think so.
Those stories always get me. But so you're on your own with your mother, and the way you characterize her is like as you know, this very kind of self, you know, serving person that didn't really know how to behave like a parent.
Yeah. Writing the book did wonders for my relationship with my mom because I not only was able to kind of process everything she didn't do, but it also made me see what was good, you know?
That's important.
And it kind of just let me process and I don't know, my heart has opened up to her in a way that before I had a lot of resentment and I'm always there for her and it's just me and her. It's always been just me and her.
Right.
But sometimes I would be like, you know, damn, like couldn't you have like taking care of business a little, like you're older now and
yeah.
And I'm the one I'm the reason you're not on the street and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just the right thing to do sometimes. And family is family. And there's a lot of who I am. And I said to her the other day, I was like, Mom, if you hadn't raised me the way you did, and I hadn't gone through that stuff and been thrown out there on my own like that, I would have had a boring book. So
that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, I've grown to, in sobriety, believe that's true, that, you know, you did get good things from them, you know, to separate them.
Yeah.
It's hard, though.
It's really hard, especially when I'm raising a, like, there were so many times in the book where my daughter was the same age that I was writing, and I'm like, for Christ's
sake. How does that have an impact on you? Because, like, you know, the 70s, but not the 70s, you were surrounded by, you know, predatory dudes who were cool, but, you know, they were what they were, and the environment was sort of forgiving or without any sort of, you know, parental guidance, even from your parents, and there was drugs around. But, yeah, I mean, you talk about these dudes coming and going, and you're a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it like to look at your daughter when she's 15 knowing that you were sleeping with a 38-year-old?
I know. It's well, like, we had very different different childhoods, and she's parented, and it's
But they look like real kids, don't they? I mean, she's a kid. When you look at someone 15...
Well, that's what I was processing. It's like, and there's a part in the book where I'm talking to my mom going, like, what were you thinking? You know, what were you doing?
Yeah.
And like, I just kept thinking about me as a mom and my daughter having to go through that stuff that I did. And it was wild.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And those dudes are still around. What were you just saying? That you saw some of those guys' names in another story?
Oh, yeah. Like, I was reading the Janis Joplin book, and Janis's early days in Port Arthur, there was a crew of guys she hung out with.
Right.
And I was just, like, flipping out because, like, one guy, I'm like, oh, geez, I had an affair with that guy when I was 15, and he must have been like 40 or something. And then there was another guy I've known since I was like 3 years old that was, he was with Janis Joplin and hanging out, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I have my own, like, memories, so it's weird to just read a book and see these connections.
Sure, between you and Janis?
Yeah, like the guy
experience?
That, like, was with her.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being a little girl and seeing, like, a stack of Playboys in his bathroom when we were there visiting and looking through him, and I'd never seen like that.
Anything.
Yeah. And I'm like, what are they doing?
And it was at his house.
Yeah. And I went home, and I remember I went in the closet and like took off my clothes and like posed like that. And like, cause I was like, it wasn't sexual. It was just like curious. Like, what are these women doing? And why are they doing it? And I'm going to go see what it's like.
Yeah. And how was it?
It was kind of scary. I was like, the thought of somebody coming in finding me.
So that was your mom's boyfriend for a
while?
No,
he was just a family friend, but I've known him since forever.
And you started doing drugs really young as well, right? I mean, how would you not? So your mom was sort of into it?
Well, for a little while,
like, it was always there.
For a little while, I was smoking pot, and like, for me, the summer between, I guess I was 12 years old, everything like exploded. 12. I started smoking cigarettes. Yeah. I started drinking Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my gateway drug. And it was disgusting. I mean, I would take a drink and retch and vomit and
Boone's
then guzzle
Farm,
more.
Right.
And it was really the first time that I felt, like I didn't feel.
Yeah.
I didn't feel the way I didn't want to feel, and I did feel the way I did want to feel.
Right.
Just
yeah.
from that disgusting stuff.
Yeah.
And
you got the warmth.
Yeah, and everybody in Texas smoked a lot of pot and did a lot of psychedelics, so that's what I had access to.
And it was Texas style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, you know, weird desert shit.
Yeah, mescaline and psilocybin and
cowboys.
Well, you probably had that in Albuquerque,
but
too.
Not the same. Yeah, Texas is its own country. You know what I mean? It's its own trip, man. I mean, there was some of it in Albuquerque, but it was a little washed out.
The era when the hippies and the rednecks kind of morphed and the whole cosmic cowboy thing was super cool.
In the early 70s?
Yeah.
All right. So, like, when did you get your first guitar? When was that?
Well, I started playing guitar at the hippie school that I went to, the commune. And it didn't occur to me I could, like, be in a band.
Right.
I just was, like, learning guitar. And then I was in England because my mom's English, and I saw Susie Quattro. And it was the first time I'd seen a woman rock star, like, playing an instrument. I mean, Janis Joplin was a rock star. And there was rock star singers.
Right.
But I'd never seen a woman just, like,
doing it,
just slamming it down. Yeah. So that changed everything. And I was like, that's what I'm going to do. And I went back and wrote my dad and asked him to help me get a guitar. Well, first I got, my mom had a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And he was, he moved an electric guitar into our house. And that was the first time I like plugged in. And
it was just hanging out there?
It was just there. And he was like, he'd escaped from Leavenworth prison, and he was like a biker and a drug dealer.
Yeah.
But he also played guitar really good. So I was like in heaven. He moves this guitar in, he moves this amp in.
It was like a stack? Was it a Marshall?
It was just like this. No, it wasn't a Marshall stack. What was it? I forget what it was.
Big amp?
It was just a
what
giant
was the guitar?
Amp. The amp, the guitar he'd made.
Oh, wow.
He'd made the guitar.
Yeah.
And so the first time I just plugged in and played my E chord that I knew, and it sounded like that. It was just really empowering. It was like, I was like,
it's like magic, right?
I'm going to do this forever. I'm never going to not do this.
Yeah.
So that, from that point on, I was off and running, and he showed me how to play. Like my first song was Johnny Be Good.
Mine too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I sat there forever just like trying to get, and I'm a lefty, but I played righty.
Yeah.
So I could do the left hand pretty good.
Yeah.
And because I'm not real coordinated with my right hand, it was really just about getting that feel. And I just was fixated on that. And then the jumping jack flash.
And that's what you were doing.
That's what I did.
And it was the time, right? So those were like, well, jumping jack flash was probably a relatively new song when you were doing that, right?
Yeah, what album was that on?
That was on Sticky Fingers?
Yeah, that was a little before. I was 16 when that came out. No, I was younger because I...
what?
As I write in the book,
Go ahead.
Sticky Fingers. I like to side one. I basically had sex and got pregnant.
That was the first... Was that the first time you had sex?
I thought it was the second time, but it turned out it was the first time because it hurt. And like, so what I thought had happened the first time,
didn't happen.
I realized, but anyway, you have to read the book, people, because it's good stories.
Are you afraid to talk about it?
No, I'll talk about anything.
Oh.
It's out there. What the hell am I going to do?
It's so funny because like, I just read the book and you're getting kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm going to.
Well, I don't know. Like, I can still be demure because it's not out, but eventually it's going to be like, everyone's going to know.
But there's also something interesting about saying it and then and writing it, isn't there? It's like, there's definitely a big difference. There's a different risk to it.
It
feels like, right?
Yeah, it's really terrifying because I've been in bands for my entire adult life since 16 or 17.
Yeah.
And that kind of means like, just being surrounded and insulated like a cocoon. A band is a cocoon. It's a gang, and you're just one of a club, a member. But to put yourself out there, I'm 61 years old, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, I'm not just in the background writing a cool song for someone else to sing, and it's a little terrifying because even though there's people are open and there's accolades and praise, but it's also you open yourself up to criticism and like, how could you do that?
When you write?
No, just like knowing that it's going to come out and people are going to read
it. It's kind of heavy because like, you know, at reading it, what's interesting is that, you know, because we grew up in the same time and that your experiences were these experiences, like I imagine that some of the feedback you're going to get around certainly the sexuality is like, you know, who are these guys? You know, because, you know, even that second time you had sex where you lose your virginity, basically. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's consensual, but not in the context of the world we're living in now. And it was sort of rapey.
Well, I mean, by today's standards, a lot was, but like, you know, and there is a rape chapter, but at the time, I mean, it's hard to explain to somebody what the 70s was like, really. And it was right after the sexual revolution of the 60s.
Yeah.
And like the first time I did something with a guy and he went and told everybody at school and I was miserable. And I went to my mom in tears. And what she said was like, you didn't do anything wrong. You did it with the wrong person. Because my mom was more worried about me being hung up about sex than she was worried about the fact that her 12-year-old had had sex.
Yeah.
It was really, I mean, twisted. By today's standards, it's twisted. But I kind of, for someone that's like this bohemian free spirit, that's really how she thought of it. And I don't know. I guess some people it's gonna sound debauched and weird, but it was just how it was.
Sure, it was happened, definitely the 70s, you know? And which is, you know, one of the reasons why people have to evolve, you know, and I understand it because I grew up then. I mean, I wasn't a girl, but it's kind of, I remember there, I mean, we were making out, I think the first time we were, you know, I held boobs was probably seventh grade. And I don't know if that's normal. Is that normal or was that the time?
At the time, it was just like, I don't know. It just seemed okay. I mean, it's not like all my friends were doing it, but there was like a lot of guys hanging around. I mean,
well, you also, because your house that you grew up in, there was drugs and your mom was kind of free spirited, I guess.
I was getting high and
you were getting high with your mom.
Yeah.
So that wasn't like, so that's a whole other trip.
Yeah.
Right. That was a different type of parenting.
Yeah.
I have to assume at that time there were people that weren't parenting like that as well.
No.
Yeah.
No, but it's just how it was.
What was that? You got your first guitar was a Telecaster?
No. Well, yeah, I wanted a guitar like Keith. So
yeah, me too.
I get them mixed up, but I either got a deluxe and he played a custom or I got a custom and he played a deluxe. But once I realized I had the wrong guitar, I was like, oh, well, whatever. But when I saw my Strat hanging in a guitar store, I traded that guitar in for it. And
you traded the deluxe for the Strat?
Yeah.
And you still have it, right?
Yeah.
It was a 62 Strat?
It's a 62 Strat, and it's just like, I'm psychotic. I just now stopped taking it out of town to play gigs with because one time I thought somebody had walked off with it and I lost my shit. I was just like,
it's a huge collector's market now. It must be worth a fortune.
Well, I was in a car accident with my band. We were playing in West Texas and somebody rear-ended us and the neck it didn't crack off, but it got a crack. Mm. So that always reduces that. I've glued it back. I don't think it's staying in tune as good. I'm kind of heartbroken about it.
That's hard.
But that guitar is just, I don't know how something that's inanimate could be such a part of you, but it really is.
Especially if it's your life. It's what you do. It's your
you've
companion.
Had it. It just represents everything.
Yeah. I don't have a... The guitar I bought because of Keith, too. I bought it at Telecaster. It was my first guitar. It was heavy as hell, too.
Yeah,
it was
like
an oak. I don't know what it was made out of, but I never pursued it as a life, you know, the musician.
Well, you're good. Thing. I've heard you play, and you could.
I want to play with people more.
I'll be in your band.
You will?
Yeah.
I'll come to Austin and play with
That'd
you.
That'd be awesome.
I have to learn how to play with people. I play with myself.
I think you could.
I think
you could do it. Because if you just start playing, then people around you are just going to start playing what you're playing.
Yeah, I've sat in with people, and I like it, you know, and I just have to carve out time to make it part of my life.
Yeah.
So, like, the through line of the book, like, you know, when I really think about, you know, it seems to me that, you know, outside of the Go-Go's, when that happens, you know, that the experience of you kind of, like, just, you know, being cool and stuffing things down and not, you know, responding emotionally to stuff and drugging yourself. That seemed to, you really established that early on, like at the beginning of your life. And it just sort of became, like, I became sort of amazed at the amount of drugs that were going on, you know, after a certain point. Let's just stay with the bands. What was the first band that you started, right, that you were in?
Well, I was kind of, you know, messed up and doing all these drugs. And when music came in my life and I decided this is what I'm going to do, it's not like I was all of a sudden I'm pure and I'm like, I'm still getting high. I'm still, you know, but I have a focus and I have, it's like kind of just like a side trip. It's like I was really more interested in getting great on the guitar. So I started having bands right away and I put together a couple in Austin and then I went to England and joined a band there. And
you were like, what, 15 or 16?
Yeah, I was like 16 then.
And I guess that's when people joined band. I guess that's when you start doing this.
Well, I was at a school where I could do anything I wanted.
The hippie school.
Yeah, so that helped. So I'm playing guitar. There's other kids around. You can do whatever you want at this school. So we started a band. And the school needed benefits, so we had gigs, you know. And then I played with the band in England, and I came back and started a punk band in Austin, the first punk band in
Austin. That must have been, like, pretty, like, going back to the sex incident and the abortion incident, that was, you were 12.
Yeah.
And then that kind of, like, that, I mean, that
was all the bad shit.
It must have fucked your head up bad.
Well, no, it's not like it fucked my head. It was just that I think it's just things that happen that that illustrate how lost and confused I was.
And did you, well, your mom took you to the clinic or what happened?
Yeah, we flew to California.
Oh, that's right. You had to fly to California.
Because it was 2 years before Roe v. Wade.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that's what the future we're looking at now.
Well, that's why I wrote about it. I wrote because I feel like people need to tell their stories and, you know, women that have had abortions.
So you were able, you told your mother that you were pregnant and then, you know, she's
like, let's take care of that.
And she figured out how.
Yeah.
And you had to fly to California. Yeah. And that was the first time you were in California?
Yeah.
That was kind of a...
Inglewood.
Yeah. Oh, nice. It was kind of a double-edged sword there. You know, you got to come here, but it was for a horrible reason.
Yeah. But to me, it was like, it was just like so much about just like making the problem go away.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like became my whole life thing, was like make the problem go away, if it's by drinking or
right.
ignoring it or stuffing it down.
Was the fundamental problem, you think, your emotional trauma about, like, you know, just the way you were, the dynamic between you and your mom and your dad kind of splitting? I mean, was there a constant pain?
I don't think it was like conscious, but I think that I felt uncared for and like not, like I didn't feel valued.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think at some deep level, I felt like if I mattered to my dad, he would come visit me more.
Right.
If I mattered to my mom, but it's not like you're articulating
it. No, of course not.
It's
but
just
you can, as a sober grown-up, you can see that.
Yeah, it's
right.
like, well, I've had a lot of time to reflect
right.
and writing the book and
yeah.
stuff, but music really saved me.
So that band, the punk band, what was that called?
The Violators.
Oh, yeah? Did
yeah.
you guys cut any wax?
No. In fact, I've been going crazy trying to find a cassette because
oh, really?
In my audiobook, I wanted to do some underscoring. And,
yeah.
and when I talk about that band, I wanted to kind of have it under there. So I was tearing my house apart looking. But we have a cassette. And
found it?
No, I'll find it though.
Okay.
I get really.
You still have them? Most of that stuff?
I got
after all.
I got so much. I have everything.
Really?
Yeah.
After all that moving?
Yeah, I've got everything. It's crazy. I just found like Go-Go's tapes, so, like me and Belinda writing songs. And
really?
Yeah. I just don't have a cassette player. I have to like, and then who's got time? Like, you barely have time to do the shit you need to do. Like,
you got to digitize that shit.
I know. I got to just dump it all. But then there's too much. There's going to be like 4 hours of us like, you know.
That's kind
of
nice though. To hear, is it wasted, rambling?
Yeah. And then like, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
So, that the thing about punk rock
yeah.
was for what it did for me was like I thought I had to be like Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page or Jimi Hendrix or Eric Clapton to be in a band.
To this, yeah.
And that's what I wanted
right,
to be. I
right.
wanted to be like in that pantheon. Like
of
there's
that,
Jimmy
those type
and
of guitar
Eric.
Players.
Yeah, and then
yeah.
there's Kathy.
yeah.
That's what I wanted. It doesn't even sound right, does it?
Right, right.
Jimmy and Eric and Kathy.
And Jim, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that was my dream. And it's still in there enough that when I meet a woman guitar player that just embodies everything I wanted to be.
When yeah.
I just like really hold her up
because sure.
it's like my vicarious thrill. And I play pretty damn good, but I'm not like that level. But when I got hip to punk rock, it was like, oh, I don't have to sit around for years
right.
practicing in my bedroom.
Noodling. Yeah.
Yeah, I can be in a band now. This
right.
is cool.
Everyone could, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's kind of like, I know we probably will touch on this later, but the Go-Go's have a documentary coming out, and the whole narrative, or not the whole, but a big part of that film is how the band started in the punk rock scene in L.A.
Right.
So it's kind of cool that I'm in Texas.
Yeah.
Discovering punk rock, starting a punk band a little earlier than when they started.
Well, was that the first wave? I mean, was that like what, mid-70s, like 77?
So that was like, yeah, probably I came back from England and it was probably, 78 where I started that band.
Oh, so it was happening in England.
It was happening. And I was there playing in this band that became Girl School. And we were a rock band. We were doing like Thin Lizzy and AC/DC and stuff. But punk rock was everywhere.
So like you were, because I was there, I don't remember, I guess I was there in 1981 and it was already kind of long gone, but that whole King's Road trip and all that fashion had really been integrated already. But I guess when you were there, it was probably fresh.
It was so fresh. And the Pistols were like it was full on shock mode, you know, just like headlines every day. And you couldn't ignore it. And
mm-hmm.
like walking around King's Road and stuff. I mean, I thought I had just gotten like hip in Austin, feeling like a rocker chick.
Yeah.
And then I'm like looking at all these punks going, oh, I'm like old fashioned. This sucks.
Right. Did you buy some clothes?
I bought a t-shirt with zippers on it. And quick study, you know.
There you go.
And went back to Austin to start that punk band. And
it's so funny. Are you friends with Steve Jones?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
What a character, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're not in touch a lot, but we've had running, our paths have crossed many times.
Yeah. Another sober dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're doing the punk thing. And what drives you? How do you get, because like, I think that this book is very thorough in its depiction of what it takes to be a musician, how a musician's life really unfolds.
Yeah.
You know, with, you know, the sacrifices you have to make and the dream you have to follow, because it seems like you knew, you know, pretty early that you were doing this.
Yeah.
And there was nothing that was going to stop that.
Yeah.
And you were going to figure out a way, but there was a certain number of serendipitous things that had to happen.
Absolutely.
For you to get to the place. But like the idea of like moving to LA and almost like just deciding to do it and then doing it.
Yeah.
Is kind of crazy.
Yeah. I think I was 19. And
what was the band then?
It was the Violators. We decided we were going to be big, like the Runaways. But we got there, instead, me and my best friend kind of had a parting of the ways.
Which one's that?
Marilyn.
Oh, okay.
Because she had a fake ID and she was going out. And I was in the horrible apartment by myself.
And what did she play?
She was the drummer.
Okay.
I made her be the drummer because she was like really cute. And I was like, oh, we'll just put you back here.
Could she drum?
Yeah, she got really good. But that wasn't totally it. But it was really, I just didn't want a female singer that didn't play an instrument.
Yeah.
And she wanted to play drums. So we had a falling out, and we actually just connected again.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's when, you were just hanging out. You were
I was hanging out. And it's like, one thing I wrote a lot about that people were surprised is that how supportive the men musicians were.
Yeah.
And people are interested in that because you always hear about, oh, it's sexist and this and that. And what I wanted to make sure and acknowledge was that I've never gotten sexism from the male musicians in my life.
Yeah.
They were always so supportive, and not in a condescending or patronizing way, but as a like, yeah. Awesome. And that's what I felt. And I don't know if I would have continued because I looked up to all these guys. There weren't women doing what I wanted to do. And I looked up to them so much. And if they had been
assholes?
Yeah, I don't know. It might have crushed me. So I was real fortunate to have people like Doug Somm and Jimmy and the Thunderbirds and all the guys and the rock and roll guys.
Yeah.
I mean, Eric Johnson gave me a guitar lesson.
When I was did it help?
Well, he was really fucking cute. So I kind of just sat there and was like enamored. But I remember he showed me, what did he show me? Like All Along the Watchtower or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But I was just like, ugh. But he later, when, you know, he became known, he one time he said in an interview, like, I gave Kathy a guitar lesson.
He remembered.
Yeah. But it was still not like, it was really supportive. And when I finally got to meet my idol, Susie Quatro, and she had a band called the Pleasure Seekers before she was Susie Quatro with her sisters. And they told me the same thing. They said the guys that, you know, the like Mark Bolan and the Yardbirds and all Bowie and all these people that were musicians supported and encouraged them. And it was always the business people that were like more
awful.
Like just not, I don't know if it's awful, but just like not really giving you credence or a legitimacy or validation or anything
right. Yeah, it's the executives and the packagers
the gatekeepers to success.
Right. So you get out here with Marilyn, she's on drums, she's got a fake ID, you're stuck at home.
I start writing songs.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. I wrote the first song I wrote in LA was Can't Stop the World, which ended up on the Go-Go's first record. It's just like, to me, how a good song just kind of just stays and stays over
decades.
Yeah,
it sounds like you reworked it. Even Vacation was reworked over
Vacation,
time.
I did with the tech. I wrote it like when I was 21, and the Textones recorded it, and even that, that version.
Which band was that? That was a band you were in before the
Go Go's
band?
Yeah, no, that was after the punk band.
Oh, that was here.
That was my my band in L.A. That played at the prison and jammed with Buddy Miles and Smokey Robinson.
Yeah, you got to tell me that story. Like, but wait, let's go back. So yeah, so that Vacation was originally recorded with them.
Yeah, and then when the Go Go's were when I got in the Go Go's, and I was like, I want to be one of the writers. So yeah, what do you got? So I'm like, I got this. Yeah. So, and then one night when I showed it to Charlotte, she goes, let's make the chorus like more chorusy, like pop chorus. And so we wrote that, and that became, you know, one of our biggest hits.
Yeah. And so how do you, I love this story about how it happens, you know, because it's just one of those things that, and you're very aware of it, that, you know, hadn't you been at that club at that moment in that bathroom, I mean, who the fuck knows, right? I mean, like, what? So, okay, so you're in the Textones. That's your band. You guys are doing okay or not really?
Well, we were getting good shows and stuff, and we opened for a lot of cool. We opened for the Stranglers, and we played with the Ramones, and it seemed all good for a kid.
Did you meet the Ramones and hang out?
Oh yeah, a bunch of times. And
nice guys.
When my favorite thing when we got successful, and I'm talking about the Go Go's. Yeah. Out of all the stuff, like all the gold record, my favorite thing was the telegram from the Ramones.
Yeah.
That said, congratulations, Go-Go's. We love you. Johnny, Dee Dee, Marky,
everyone's
Joey.
Gone.
I can't, so weird. I still can't get over it.
Yeah. It's getting me choked up.
So, yeah, we were getting plenty of shots, but all the bands that were coming up around us were doing better.
Like
the Plimsolls and the Go-Go's even, before I was in.
You mentioned the Blasters.
The Blasters. Everybody was doing good, and I just thought, and the Textones seemed like we'd become like me singing my songs and Carla singing her songs. She was my mate.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I need to leave the band and figure something. Yeah, so I quit, and I was kind of floundering. I was like, well.
And at that time, though, who was it? So the X was happening?
X was happening, and the Weirdos. Yeah.
It's kind of an exciting time.
It was great. LA was great during that era.
And the punk scene, too?
Yeah, just the Alley Cats and so many cool bands.
Right,
the Bags
and
just so many great bands. And it was a real, it reminded me of growing up in Austin, because like in Austin, I wasn't a snob. I'd go like dancing to a country band. I'd go see a blues band, go see the cover rock band. So in LA, when I moved here, there was like, you know, the Skinny Tie, like power pop bands, like the 2020 and The No and all these cool bands. And then there was like the Blasters and the rockabilly bands, Levi and the Ripcords. And then there was the punk bands and then the artsy kind of punk bands and then the hardcore. So there was such a variety and spectrum of music, which I took to because that's how I grew up.
Sure. It was all happening at that point.
Yeah.
It was before things started to sort of branch out.
Yeah. And the message, and it was really organic.
Yeah.
Like those organic scenes.
And there was no hair metal yet.
No.
Almost.
No.
Now let's go over this moment, because I think it's a great moment where, you know, you're just like toiling away, writing your songs and playing with this band. You break up the band.
No, they stayed. They went on.
Oh, the Tones?
Textones. Yeah, I just left.
You left, and you didn't know what was going to happen or what you were going to do.
No, I thought I was, I had no doubts. There's something about being young, and I don't know, I had no doubts.
You just knew. Like there's something about once you commit to something, I know it with comedy as well, that either you're going to always have a plan B in your head or you're not.
Yeah.
And you weren't that kind of person.
I wasn't either.
It was just sort of like, this is going to
And I don't know if it's youth or what, but I just was like, no.
I think it's a way of thinking. Yeah. Like, you know, you just didn't see another option for yourself.
But also, I was always really determined. I think anything I had decided, I would have done well at.
I'm sure. Yeah. And what?
It's like this need to be like, I matter. I matter. I'm going to show you I matter. And it's all it's like who you want to matter to is your dad or your mom.
Right. But, well, I noticed that in the book too, because I've definitely related to that when you got sober, that there's a certain sort of like, well, I'm going to do this. Like, if it wasn't for me being competitive about my day count, I don't know if I would have stayed sober. Because once I got
I'll
in.
I'll show them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to be the best.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least I'm going to win.
Yeah.
Somehow.
I know. It's a good quality. And maybe it comes from negative circumstances, but it's...
It can bite you in the ass, but sure, it's a good quality.
I think it is. I told my dad on his deathbed, my dad was like, oh, I'm sorry, all this stuff. And I said, you know, don't be sorry. I go, if you had been there, you would have never let me do what I did. You would have made me go to college and you would have this and that. And I was like, my life went the way it did. And a lot of it's because you weren't there, you know.
How did he take that?
I think he died the next day. I think it let him, I think it released him. That's not funny. But I think it like gave him, I think it absolved, like, I don't know.
You absolved him.
Yeah, in a weird way.
He was living in it.
Yeah, I think he, because we got close in the last 8 months of his life, like really close.
Huh.
And we had a lot of serious talks because he was lucid through his last breath.
But you were able to close that, like as a sober person to take you know, understanding how to handle that stuff.
It was really, and I said, this is our journey. This is our journey, you know, and it was a really magical and healing and heartbreaking time. But it was a wonderful conversation to say, like, yeah, I go, I'm not going to say it didn't affect me not having a dad, but I said, I had good relationships. I had good men in my life. I'm really practical. It's just, I didn't die, you know.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
Yeah. Well, that's nice, man. It's nice that you were able to get that, to let him off the hook.
Yeah, I think it's important.
So, okay, so you're kind of in between bands.
Yeah.
And you don't really, you know, you're driven, but you don't know what's next. You kind of, all throughout the book, you're sort of like, I knew, you know, I had to make something happen.
Yeah.
Something had to give.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's your use, what's your drug use at that point?
I was doing, well, alcohol has always been my main thing. And I think I really liked cocaine because I could drink longer.
Sure. But like at the time you met Charlotte?
I was doing like... Drinking, always drinking, and then when I could get my hands on it, I would do
blow.
Yeah.
So what was the moment? Like, walk me through that meeting with her.
Well, it was Christmas night, and there's this amazing flyer that's from the whiskey that has, like, Suzy Quatro, who was my first, like, person.
Your hero.
Yeah, that made me go, I can be
in a
band.
Or your role model.
Yeah, and then there was some of my friends' bands, and then there was... X playing that night, and then there was my first show. So that on one flyer from the whiskey, it's in my book. It's such a cool flyer. It's like about my whole life.
To see X at that time must have been pretty much great.
Well, they ruled, you know, and they still do. They're still, I mean, amazing to me. My mom had come out to visit. I'm like staying up on Sunset Plaza at a friend's house, and she's out of town, and I'm just Christmas with my mom, and then I go down to the whiskey to see X. And I see Charlotte from the Go-Go's, and she's like, hey, do you play bass? And I'm like, yeah.
But you didn't, right?
No, but, I mean, it's not like I had never held one or
anything.
Sure,
I know, I get it. You can play guitar, you can say yes.
That's what I figured.
Sure.
And then she just like says, well, our bass player is sick, and we got four shows at the Whiskey coming up, and I was just like, ding, 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 yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do it. And I went home right away, and just like all gears were just churning.
Sure.
And I was like, called her the next day, get me a cassette.
Yeah, yeah.
And I borrowed a bass, and I learned their whole set, and it became clear. And I had seen the Go-Go's. I'd seen them when I first moved to
LA.
When I first moved to LA, I didn't take them seriously. And then I saw them when they came back from England, and Gina Shock had joined as the drummer. And I was like, oh, okay, this band is cool.
Yeah.
But I didn't know their song. I wasn't like a fan I went to every show or anything.
Yeah.
But listening to that rehearsal tape and learning their songs, I was like, man, I like this band.
Uh-huh.
I like these songs. This is a good band. And as soon as I got in a room with them, it was like everything I'd ever looked for.
Sure.
It's like I wanted to be in an all-female band. I wanted to be in a band that got somewhere. Like all the bands I looked up to, there was no women bands.
Yeah.
And I was just like, so to me, it was like it just checked off every box of everything I'd wanted. And I fell in love.
Yeah.
I fell in love with that band.
And was it?
I would have played the freaking tambourine. I would have done anything. at that point to be in that band. I just loved them.
And it took, how long did it take to really click?
Oh, right away.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like within, I don't know what happened, but after 8 shows at the Whiskey and the press talked about the shows, and within like maybe at the most 2 weeks, I'm just like, in my mind, I'm just like, I got to be in this band. And then they asked me to stay, and I was like, yep.
Wow.
And then 4 months later, we had a record deal.
It's interesting, though. It didn't happen overnight, mm-hmm. and it was a real struggle because of the perception of women.
Yeah.
Correct?
Well, it was what our manager was told repeatedly was, it's cool, good band. We can see that they're popular, but there's never been a successful, that's what they would say, successful all-female band.
And I felt like they saw it as a novelty or something.
Yeah, and we were considered a novelty. I mean, I write in the book, like on our first tour, we did everything and nobody passed on us. Like every radio person, and it wasn't like they wanted to meet us so they could add us to the programming.
Right.
They wanted to see what we were like.
Yeah.
So there was something about the novelty that appealed to people.
Right.
But it didn't help in terms of getting a record deal or getting airplay, or that's what people don't realize. Like I wrote in the book, I don't even know if I realize stuff till I meticulously.
Yeah, it happens with the process of writing.
Yeah, and when you're procrastinating, like you still want to feel like you're doing shit, so you're like researching and getting everything right. So
you learn things about yourself because they come out of you.
Yeah.
And you put things together, right?
Yeah, the first thing I did before I started was I made playlist of every song of every year. So, and I would just play it while I was writing because the music took me right back to that minute.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. Like every, it just never failed. It's like, oh, that's how I felt. I know how I felt because I'm listening to this. And that's what I was listening to then.
But also like the kind of detail you put into, you know, showing, you know, not just getting the record deal, but once the record was out, how you had to slog that thing, you know, get out there, the amount of promo you had to do and the amount of time it takes back then to sort of mine a record for hits, to make hits, and this sort of, you know, serendipitous creation of MTV, and that you were there at the beginning of what really defined them in terms of making hits.
Yeah, that's I think that's one of the reasons we succeeded, because it was the rogue DJs, the college DJs, MTV, Saturday Night Live, like, was huge for us.
But like you had like it was this was vinyl records, and you had to hit everything, and you had to sell those pieces, record.
Yeah.
And it just kept building. I didn't realize until I really read, and I just read Jerry Wexler's autobiography, but the amount of time it took to make that record a hit, to get...
9 months it took to get Our Lips Are Sealed, the first single. It took 9 months of solid touring for it to go to like 26.
That's crazy.
9 months.
And then it was Saturday Night Live and MTV that took it over the top?
That and opening for the Police. So it was like...
Ah, right.
It was like just that synchronicity of things that kind of... And then fans like... And for us, it wasn't even when we were in a van and playing all the clubs, that circuit of clubs that every band hits.
Yeah.
They were sold out. I mean, so you feel like you're succeeding compared to where you come from, like a sold out club in Atlanta or a sold out club in, you know, Minnesota or Minneapolis is that's like success.
Sure.
Like, what makes you think that you can go do that everywhere? So I called it pinnacles of success because every little thing along the way to me was like my dream had come true.
Right.
And so it's not like you're like sitting around waiting for a hit. To me, it felt like it was like just to be able to be on tour.
To be popular, to be in a great band.
Yeah, and to be making a record in New York City, you know, to be like...
And John Belushi took a liking to you?
Yeah, and like people that are icons loving your band. It's like there's so much good shit happening. The last thing you're worried about is whether you have a hit.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And but how was Belushi? Great guy?
So great, yeah. Yeah, great guy.
It's interesting in the sort of the one of the through lines of the book is you know sort of not realizing you have a drug problem, even though it wasn't massive, but a few people around you went down.
Yeah,
but you couldn't compare yourself to that because you weren't a dope person or
yeah,
whatever.
I felt like oh, I don't know. I think that's part of what an alcoholic addict does is they look at everybody else and think that they're worse.
I was one of those people. Like, I don't do heroin. Yeah. It's not my bag.
Yeah, you think that they're worse. So, and plus you're fun. Like I was fun.
Yeah. I don't know how you would know unless you asked Charlotte about it, you know, how much because it seemed like everyone else was partying as well. But do you really have a sense of how much your substance abuse and alcoholism affected, you know, the decisions the bands made around you?
Well, looking back, what I realized is that it made me a stunted, like, emotional, like, infant. Mm. I mean, I was just like, I had no capacity for compassion or empathy or for understanding what someone else was going through. And there's things, I think my drinking definitely affected the band, even if it was, I can only be responsible for my part, but there was people right next to me who I considered my sisters that were going through things that it just like went, psh.
Yeah, because you were worried about yourself.
It's like, you know, it's just like you're just a teenager and you're
self-obsessed.
They say when you start drinking like an alcoholic that you...
That's when you stop.
Yeah, and like when you get sober, you're at the emotional... So when I got sober, I was like a 14-year-old emotionally, you know?
Yeah, I buy that. So once you guys are rising and become this huge band, it seems that you didn't think it would ever end.
Oh, I never thought it would end. I mean, for everyone but me and Gina, it was their first band, pretty much. Yeah. Charlotte had been in a band, but it was but Gina and I had been like, we'd been trying to make it, well, for a year, like four years.
4 years, and you're like 22.
Yeah, exactly. So, but to me, it was like, nobody would ever, and like, to me, the main focus of my life was to keep it, because this band represented not only my dream come true and getting to do all the stuff, but it meant I could take care of myself, and no one had ever taken care of me. And to be able to really take care of yourself was huge to me. It was like, I have security now. I never felt secure.
And through that, through the agreements with IRS records and whatever was going on, you felt that you were compensated properly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You guys did good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for the time, yeah. And yeah, I mean, to me, I was poor growing up. So to me, like, I mean, when I joined the band, we were getting like our rent paid in $40 a week. And
by the label?
No, by just the band.
Uh-oh.
And I was getting unemployment. And
yeah.
Like, I thought, this is great. And then...
Then you got off unemployment.
Yeah, and then I got like $1,500 a month, you know, when we started doing better. And I, like, so to me, just getting anything.
And the contracts were good. The publishing, it seemed like, was like divvied up pretty well.
Well, everyone was smart to keep their publishing.
Yeah.
You know, so we all the songwriters kept their publishing. And our... The deals were as good as what they were. I mean, we just renegotiated our royalty rate with the people that own the masters now.
Just now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's a deal that's from like 1980. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
And do those songs still make money?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I've been making money off vacation for like 40 years. It's crazy. No, it's not always. It might be like $6,000 one year.
But like if a commercial uses it?
Yeah, if a commercial happens, it's like, and when you're like broke, because I've been up and down in this business, and when you're broke, you're just like, come on.
Somebody make a commercial.
And it never happens. But when you're not broke, it's like all comes. It's a weird like universal law.
Yeah, and I think it was sort of interesting that there this idea, like I'd like to talk a little bit about how, you know, all the kind of soup of different styles that you came out of in LA, and the fact that punk wasn't that far behind you guys, that you did represent a kind of a new mode, like something, an accessible sort of punky, like it wasn't really new wave, because you guys were rock, but there was something that represented everything that was going on at that time.
I think so, and I think that, like, I really don't think the Go-Go's get a lot of credit for just being an indie band. Mm-hmm. Like, forget being the first, I mean, don't forget, but besides being the first all-female band that had a number one record that we wrote and performed and everything, we were also one of the first indie bands to get huge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And after us, there was like REM and, you know, right. they got big labels because they, like a lot of the big labels looked at IRS and what they were doing. IRS was our little label.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of bands benefited from our success, and I don't know if we get credit for that.
Well, you know, we never get the credit we should.
No, we got to tell them. Get a big sandwich board.
There's still a little alcoholic thinking in there. It's like, how come there's no plaque? It's worse there, you know what I mean?
Where's mine?
Exactly. God damn it. Doesn't that go away? Come on, 31 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not even the, I think it's just the age. It's like, you get to be like, I mean, you just get to a point where it's like, why are you even doing it? It's not like you're trying to be the most relevant person in the world, but it's like, you're just doing it because that's what you do. And like the validation just isn't that important anymore.
I hope so. I mean, I get that. Well, that's another vibe I get throughout the book where it's just like, it took you a long time to let that shit go, man.
Oh, yeah.
So you got the big hit record. Then you do another record with your song on it, Vacation, which is also a big hit, but it didn't sell as much as the first record.
Yeah.
And when you went out on the road, it was a little different. But you guys played Madison Square Garden. Yeah, you did big deals.
The second record didn't sell as many, but we were touring at our peak. We were headlining arenas.
Right.
So it didn't feel that bad.
Right.
That you sold 2 million instead of 4 million. But the third record, the chapter is called Shrinking and Sinking because you're selling hundreds of thousands. Like if we'd started
records.
Like that, yeah, that's fine.
Right.
But when you go from millions, you start feeling like you're on the decline.
And it's a sad story, but it's not an unusual story.
Yeah.
In rock and roll, really, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to follow up the first hit record and certainly the second hit record because the expectation either becomes like keep repeating yourself. Or let's try to find lightning in a bottle again. I mean, in general, right?
Well, we went through a phase with the third record where it became like really important that we be taken seriously, you know? And I think like we toured.
In what way?
I don't know.
It's that was the other thing I was like, you know, your regret around not selling out in a way. Like, you know, when you guys had opportunities, when your songs were huge to be used in marketing, you guys were like, everyone democratically decided we don't want to sell out. And then like all of a sudden you see, I remember when Lou Reed did that fucking Vespa ad.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah.
But now there's no shame at all to a degree. It's just part of the business. It's part of your personal branding.
Well, it's like, unfortunately, you know, marketing and that has just permeated
everything.
Aspect
that's right.
of
yeah.
life.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And a musician is going to, you know, like any artist, you're going to do what you can to do your art.
Right.
You know,
and to make money if you want to make money.
Yeah.
But then, you know, by the time you guys decided to do it, you know, it was already
Suzuki. And it was like a big flop.
So, okay, but tell me about this idea that you wanted to be taken seriously on the third record.
Yeah, I don't know. We were just kind of consumed with that. I think there was a backlash from just being, it's like these like frothy. I mean, I have all the press, and when I was writing the book, I'm looking, and I'm like, they just keep saying these things like bouncy
like
and frothy cute. And
right.
And I'm just like, really? We're just like a rock and roll band. And I think we were kind of backlashing against that and just wanted to be taken seriously.
So they thought you were cute. And
that's
you
what
know,
they would say, was, just because we're
again,
girls.
A gimmick or a novelty or whatever.
I don't know what it was. It was just like, I mean, and I've talked to journalists that say, well, you guys weren't exactly doing stuff to counter that. I'm like, well, what? We were just being ourselves. Like, what would we do to counter it? And sometimes it's like you'd go to a photo session and they'd have a stylist and they'd be like, oh, we thought you could wear this. And
a lot
of times we'd be like, no, fuck that. We're not doing that. But a lot of times you'd be like, yeah, whatever. Give it, you know, you just want to go back to your hotel room.
Right.
And like whatever's going to make it fast.
Yeah. And then there's some dumb pictures out in the world.
Oh, there's some hideous pictures, like unbelievably hideous pictures where we're like being dressed up like little dolls.
Yeah.
You know?
So on those first two tours, on the first two records, I mean, you guys toured the world. I mean, you did a lot of dates, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we did a lot of dates.
Like, that was, you put the hours in.
And we didn't say no. I think it took, it took till like we broke up and got back together, which isn't in this book, but it took us like till we were in our 30s to like understand that you can say no and go, no, we're not doing that.
So when you did finally, like when things started to come unglued, it was around that third record, right?
Yeah, things were just falling apart like crazy.
Because people wanted to do their own thing or what?
Just a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, definitely the alcohol and stuff was playing a play and the drugs. But, you know, Jane quit the band and it's like chemistry. You take one crucial element out and the chemistry is different. And all I cared about was like, we got to keep going. We got to keep this together. Okay, Jane's leaving, but we're going to fix it. We're going to fix it. And
you couldn't see being without them.
Couldn't see it. I mean, by that time I was completely wrapped up. I was like, you couldn't have said, hey, you used to go see the T-Birds in Austin.
Right.
It was like I was go-go, Kathy.
Right.
And thank God I learned, like I realized that I'm me, you know. But after losing it all, but thank goodness I lost it all. But at the time, that's all I wanted was to keep the band.
Buzz of being that big must have been amazing. The sort of cachet and entree you had into worlds that you didn't have before. The touring and the money and the excitement.
I wanted to be the Stones. You know, I wanted to be around for albums and
I think that was an interesting observation you made in the book about, you know, how they weren't, you know, this idea that like, why can't someone else sing it? Why can't someone else play it? Like, you know, you probably should have let that happen.
We should have like grown and changed, but we were really rigid. And, you know, again, like going back at that time when it fell apart, one of the first things that made it fall apart was Jane said, I want to sing a song. And
right.
We were like, no, this isn't the way the band is.
That seems crazy to me.
Now you look
back at that, but in that moment, Do you understand the reasoning that went into you guys thinking?
Well, we started thinking like, well, what if everybody wants to sing a song?
Yeah, what if?
And what, you know, then what's Belinda going to do? Belinda's the star. She's the singer.
Was that established like that?
Because it was working and it's just the way it was.
It's just the way it was.
And I didn't mind. I mean, I had a template in my mind of the Stones, you know, the Stones.
Yeah, but Keith always sang a couple and he played bass on some shit.
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of guidance by that point either. Our long-term manager was gone. We had like Suits basically managing us and we weren't guided. We were like unparented.
Right.
And no one really keeping... You know, by that time, I think they were like glad to see us break up because then they could just focus on the star and get rid of these other ones. They're just a pain in the ass.
Huh. So once Jane left, you guys tried to keep the band together?
Yeah.
And you brought someone else in?
Yeah, we brought someone in. I moved to guitar, which was like I was like happy about because I wanted to play. I like playing guitar. I like playing bass too. But, you know, if there was an opening, I would take that one.
Yeah.
And, so, and we just tried, but Charlotte got sober and came back, and I didn't get it. I thought, oh, good, she's back, and we're going to go on now with sober Charlotte.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize at the time how it was asking way too much for a newly sober person to just jump in with all these dysfunctional... Well, sure. And I shouldn't lump everyone, because pretty much...
You?
Well, I'm not going to tell other people's story.
Right,
but,
sure.
But I was definitely like, why wouldn't you want to go write songs with me? You know,
right.
Don't worry, I won't do any blow in front of you.
Yeah, sure. That thing we all do. Are you okay if I, you don't mind if I drink, do you? Yeah, that kind of thing. So, didn't work.
No, it fell apart and I was devastated. But I also couldn't foresee, like if you'd told me like, hey, in 2020, you're still going to be relevant and your music's still going to matter and you're still going to have a career that is a part of your life but isn't your life. I mean, if I'd known that, I would have been like, yeah, good.
Right.
but at the time, it just felt like that was like and it was all going to end. But I mean, it's insane. This band has...
But it did end, though. I mean, it's like... Yeah, I mean, things have like ebbed and flowed and things have happened. But I mean, you know, you were fucked for years after that.
Yeah.
And it, you know, in the, you know, I can't imagine the amount of booze and drugs and men that, you know, especially someone with your kind of like compulsion, what it took to sort of like keep those demons at bay, just the resentment demons or the jealousy demons. You know, when Belinda, like you write about, you know, Belinda's career taking off, and it's just like, it's fucking that kind of like bile and like heart crushing jealousy is just horrendous.
Well, except I can't say that it was jealousy and stuff. What it was more like was it was just like what you were saying. It's like, I deserve it too. I've never begrudged anybody else success.
Right.
Because I know what kind of work goes into it. So it wasn't so much I was eaten alive with jealousy,
right.
But what it was like, I deserve shot too.
Right, right.
I'm good.
Where's mine?
Yeah, mine?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm working my ass off. I'm putting a band together and we're a good band and I'm playing at the clubs and I'm starting over and I'm doing everything the right way. And I've got big producers and I've got big people like that believe in me. So
there's some real heartbreak in that stuff where, you know, when, you know, the singing just didn't work out and just like, ugh.
Oh, it was painful. It was so painful because I just wanted to be in a band.
And then that horrible thing that happens when you're in your new house.
Yeah. Yeah.
What the fuck was that?
It was crazy. It was like what they call a home invasion robbery now, but back then it was just insanity.
But you guys were just partying sleeping?
We partied.
It was you and Charlie and...
Me and Charlie Sexton and Carlene Carter, and we stayed up writing songs, just having a good old time, and probably conked out around dawn.
Right.
And then like a few hours later, a guy, and I don't know what he's doing at the top of Sunset Plaza. It's like, I mean, how the hell do you get up there?
Yeah.
But he apparently came into the house and woke up, they were in my guest room, and then proceeded to terrorize us and psychologically just, like, it was... I mean, I'll never forget it. I still cry. I mean, I didn't cry till I wrote about it. And
it seemed very bizarre how he went about doing all this shit.
Yeah, it was crazy. And like I wrote,
he ties you guys up.
Yeah, he tied us up, and he like threatened us, and he said he was going to kidnap me, and he got butcher knives from my kitchen that he was going to, I guess, put in our backs or something. And I had a struggle with him, and I just kept, your mind is just like churning. And what you don't realize is how you're just ingrained from the time you're a kid, like, be good, do what you're told. You won't get in trouble. You won't get punished. But you're also, so that's all there. And then I got to survive. I got two people. I'm sure he's by himself. We can take him. Come on, guys, let's take him. No, do what he, so you can't get everyone, like, you can't do it by yourself.
And you ended up running out.
I ended up pretending like I was tied up, but I wasn't. And so my only thing, they were tied up, my friends, and he kept wandering around the house and stealing stuff and I just...
He sounded like a crazy person.
I think he was a crazy person, but he was also, I think he had military background because he kept using terms. But I wrote a song, I did a soundtrack to this book. When I was done, I just didn't feel done. And I wrote a song about that chapter. And I just was sobbing when I wrote. It's weird, like the writing the music opened things up on a deeper level.
So you wrote a bunch of original music for the soundtrack?
Yeah, I got to give it to you. Yeah. And the same with the chapter where I got raped. I just wrote about it. I'm like, oh, this sucked, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I wrote the song.
When was that? When did that happen?
That was like 14. I was 14 and I hitchhiked to Houston and got in a bad situation. But in my mind, it was never rape because I'd gotten myself in a bad situation and the guy wasn't leaving me alone. So I finally just said, just do it. So I wrote the song called Just Do It. And as soon as I wrote the lines, if I can't stop you, I can let you. Like just like trying to get that power of being powerless.
Right.
And it was like a key that unlocked that 14-year-old thing. And for 3 days, I was like a mess. I was like sobbing and mourning. Like, why wasn't anybody fucking taking care of me? Why wasn't anybody looking out for me? Why wasn't this guy leaving me alone, you know? And what I wrote in the book was like, I was promiscuous. It wasn't like I didn't have sex. And it was all really a memorable bad sex. But that was the only time I never forgot because I sobbed. I was crying the whole time, which was a bummer for him.
Yeah. Well, but because you realized you'd been, you know.
I didn't want to do it. I didn't. I mean, the other times I had sex, it might have been for maybe I liked him, or maybe I just didn't give a shit, or maybe I was just fucked up and there was nothing to do. But it was always because I was like okay with it.
Right.
But that was the one time I wasn't okay with it. And even in the 70s where everybody was just having sex a lot, it was just in a box. It was just buried. And I wrote about it, and then I wrote the song. And I'm scared to do the song in public. I'm scared I'll just cry. Every time I do it, I cry.
But that's okay. Eventually,
I think it's uncomfortable for people when you just start like crying.
I guess that's, maybe it's true. Maybe, okay. But
what if you were doing a show and just started crying?
I've cried before publicly, and you can choke it back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do comedy, so it's a little different. But I mean, like,
that would be really bad. No, it's funny.
Yeah,
I'm telling
you. Just wait a minute. But so between, that horrible event and then the break-in, I mean, that's heavy shit, man.
It was like something that I had PTSD for years. And, I'm still friends with Charlie and Carlene, and we still talk about
how horrible it was.
Oh, yeah. It was like we thought we were going to die.
Yeah.
We thought we were going to die.
Oh, my God.
We thought we were going to be murdered at the top of Sunset
Plaza.
You
might have been.
Well, that's what the police told me when they came, and I was like, I just kept talking to him. Did I do the right thing? And the cop's like, you're alive. You did the right thing,
Yeah.
Because to me, I just kept thinking, I got to be human. I got to be a human being. And I kept joking with him.
Interesting.
I was like, he'd say like, where's the drugs? Where's the drugs? And I'd be like, oh, you should have come by a few hours ago.
Yeah.
I just kept trying to be like a real person.
So this is during the period where you don't have a band anymore.
Yeah, that's 85 that happened.
So I like that you moving towards hitting bottom involved some more heroes in a way, because you were still pretty fucked up when somehow or another you managed to meet Keith Richards finally.
Yeah.
And so funny, because when I met him, when I interviewed Keith Richards, I hadn't smoked in a decade. And
did you ask for a cigarette?
Well, I did, but I was on nicotine lozenges. I just wanted to hold it because he was smoking Reds. So I'm just fucking holding it, and he's smoking. And at some point during the interview, he threw a lighter at me, and I fucking lit it. And I hadn't smoked in a decade, and I thought in my head, like, well, I'm on the nicotine lozenges. I'm not going to get hooked.
And then you were hooked right away, right?
No.
Oh.
But I was happy to smoke my one cigarette in a decade with Keith. No, I stayed on the nicotine lozenges.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I didn't go back to cigarettes.
See, I'm like, if I smoked one now, I'd be smoking a pack.
Well, I was on nicotine lozenges for a decade, man. I'm 6 months off of that shit, and I'm going squirrely right now.
Oh, that's great, though.
I'm full of rage and insanity.
Yeah, but nicotine's it's bad,
fucked, man.
And it's like, what I realize is how much it keeps you a wall away from connecting with people.
Hey, unfortunately, when you remove that wall from me, it's usually a lot of hostility. You might want that wall up. I'm dealing with it right now. I'm squirrely now. I don't know why.
It's hard. It's uncomfortable.
It hits me like 6 months in. I always start up something. Smoke a cigar, get back on the nicotine or something. I think this might be the longest I've been with like nothing. Nothing.
So how are you doing different? What are you doing different?
I need to start doing something different. I'm not doing enough different. I got to go to a fucking meeting tonight or something. I don't want to drink or nothing, but I'm squirrely.
I know that. I get really uncomfortable just being in my skin.
It feels itchy, like from the inside.
I just get really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And the older you get, the worse it gets, because then you're getting uncomfortable about like real shit that's probably going to happen to you. So then you pile that on there.
The real shit problem.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I got a stomach ache. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've got a toothache. I'm going to get, my brain's going to get infected.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Like, that's shit you don't even think about.
Good stuff.
It's all about like dental work and pooping when you're past 60.
That's for sure. Yeah. Is everything working? Yeah. Everything okay? What is that lump? What is that? Was that spot there? So you meet Keith.
I couldn't believe it, because I thought I'd meet him when we got to open for the Stones.
Yeah.
I thought I'd meet him then, and it didn't happen. And it's like, I've been pretty good most of my life. Like, I just think of people. Like, if I meet somebody, I don't want to be like, oh, I saw you at this concert.
Sure.
I want to be.
Yeah, have a real moment.
Yeah, so yeah. I've always kind of just remembered they're just people. And if you want to, you just talk about something. And to actually meet him and then tell him about my guitar. And
oh, yeah, that you're going to leave it to him.
Yeah, and he was really... And then later, in the 90s, I got to cross paths with him a couple... He actually played that Strat.
He did?
Yeah, he played it. I was at Don Was's studio.
Uh-huh.
And like at one point, I was like, every guy I know... that I've said, you know, show me something on the guitar. Will you show me a couple of your favorite licks?
So yeah.
It was like it didn't fall in the time frame of this story, but it was my favorite Keith.
And what did he play? What did he show you?
Well, I was really, really into blues, like really going deep into blues.
Yeah.
So he was like, do you know this? And I'd be like, yeah, I've learned that one. And
and
I'd say like, do you know Frankie Lee Sims? And he'd like, yeah, Lucy May Blues. And it was just like bonding on like Texas blues. It was really cool.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it's not like, I don't know if he saw me, I don't know if he'd be like, hey, Kath, but it was still, for me, it was good enough as a lifelong fan.
Yeah. And then your bottom somehow managed to involve Johnny Thunders somehow.
Yeah, my last drunk, I blacked out. And I wasn't a big blackout drinker. I had really bad hangovers by that time that would make me, I would wake up sometimes. Because when I would drink, I would just do things that I normally wouldn't do. I'd do drugs I normally wouldn't do. I'd have sex with people I normally wouldn't have sex with. Mm. And so I woke up with a lot of shame and physical horror, but I didn't have a lot of blackouts.
Yeah.
And that was the second blackout that I'd had. And it was a really bad hangover. And I just was done.
That was it. And someone had planted the seed, Carlene.
Carlene had gotten sober. And
a lot of people, I guess, in your life had gotten sober, but you may not have known all of them at that time, huh?
Yeah, Charlotte and I weren't friends at that time. I mean, I called Charlotte 4 months into my sobriety. I still had her phone number in my brain. I'm like, I'm sober.
That's a great, like, you know, but before I go into the sober part, how was it seeing Johnny Thunders live?
Oh, well, I was blacked out while he played, but I always got to sit in the rehearsal, and I'd seen him other places too. I'm a big Johnny Thunders fan. I mean, he was just like, some people are just the real deal.
So, when you had the moment of clarity where you found the window to make the decision to go to a meeting, how was your resolve? You wrote a nice little passage on that mixture of everything you. About who you are wants to keep using, but you can't anymore.
Well, it was like, I felt so bad. It was easy when I made the decision, but the next day I felt a little better.
Mm.
And immediately the doubt was like, well, maybe I should wait a little while.
Yeah.
I'll do this tomorrow. I'll do it next week. Yeah. I'll get back to LA first.
Right.
And I was just so demoralized with my life and my inability to make anything happen. I was putting bands together and people were giving me breaks and nothing was happening.
Oh, the sad story about playing gigs where no one was showing up.
Yeah, and it's like I had things, but nothing was working out.
Yeah.
Nothing. And even like having a great boyfriend, that wasn't working. Nothing was working. Anything good wasn't working. Nothing bad, nothing good.
Yeah.
And there was just something about that thought, like if I stop drinking, one thing will change. And if one thing changes, maybe that's enough to fucking feel better about my life.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, so I didn't want to, even though I felt better and thought, well, maybe I'll wait. Part of me was able to hold on to that thought. Like, no, one thing's going to change. Mm. You're going to make this, you can do this. You can change this one thing.
Yeah.
You can't get a career. You can't make your band happen. You can't,
right.
You can't be financially secure. You can't be happening and all that, but you can do this.
Yeah.
And that'll change. And it was like it's the foundation of everything good. I mean, I'm sitting here now
because
I got sober.
Yeah.
I have a daughter now because I got sober. I'm surrounded by loved ones, and I get to be in the Go-Go's, and I get to throw my guitar in the car and go play a gig at the Continental Club, and I get to do all this shit because I'm sober, and it's like the best thing. But yeah, going back to that moment, I think what I said was like, there's something divine about it. There's a divine moment, and if you blow it off, and I've seen it happen. I've seen a lot of people where they, like, I was real close. I was right at that point. Like, I'll go back to LA and then I'll get sober.
Yeah.
And if you, who knows whether you're going to make it.
That's right. And it's still a day at a time for a lot of people.
That was like a life-changing moment to realize that I could lose my sense of self and come back.
Well, right, because you had all this sort of like, you know, insane trauma and PTSD and emotional stifling of a lifetime.
Stuffed down, yeah.
Yeah, but like, you know, and it all had to come, you know, flying out of you.
And it, when it happened, I mean, I'd been sober for like, I guess, 9 months or something. And
when that happened?
It was terrifying. It was like absolutely terrifying. But I think like what I said was like, I had to... The first thing was like, I got to know I can have a good time.
Yeah.
Because I associated every good time with drinking.
I like that stuff. Yeah.
I like, first thing was like, just, if I can have a good time, I can do this. That took a while. I didn't have a good time for a while.
Yeah.
I was just hanging in there.
I don't know if I have a good time in general.
Come on. Just,
I do okay sometimes, you know what I mean? I like to, but even with me, it's like most of the good feelings come from like stuff that's compulsive.
Yeah.
You know, like eating or what, you know what I mean? Or like buying a thing, getting a new guitar, you know, like.
No, I'm still, it's uncomfortable being a human. It's just
and I have fucking food issues. I'm fucking squirrely as shit, man.
Me too. I like it. I'm really ritualistic, like where I'll do the same thing every day until like I replace it with something else.
Yeah.
Like I got to have this bagel every
day. But don't you ever just sort of like go, fuck it, and just eat a pie?
No,
that's good.
But I do have issues with food. But I mean, my daughter, like, she came home one day, and I was like peeling the paint off the wall, like strip by strip. And she's like, "Mom," like, and I would go out and do it like all the time. And she'd come.
What do you mean, do it for what reason?
Just because I was like obsessive. Like, I don't know why. I just had to peel it off.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, "Mom, are you peeling the paint again?" I'd be like, "Yeah, you should try it." and she kind of starts peeling. She goes, "This is weird. You're weird."
Yeah. But she tried. So what ultimately happened with the girls, the Go-Go's, like after all said and done? What, you guys are okay now?
We're like actually levels of okay that I didn't even know about could happen. Like,
how many times have you guys gotten back together?
Well, a lot of people don't realize this, but we broke up in 85.
Yeah.
We got back in 90. We did a tour. We broke up for like 4 years. From like 95 almost all the way to 2012.
Yeah.
We toured a lot. We did a lot of cool shit. We like played at Muhammad Ali's like Fight for Life thing. We did like, we played at the Kennedy compound or Mardi Gras floats, all kinds of opportunities that aren't like in the
public
eye. The
original lineup.
Oh yeah. So this happened, and we tour in the summer. We tour with the B-52s, or we do this.
Do fun tours.
We've had a really good career for a long time, but it was a part of our life. It wasn't the whole life.
Right.
The musical on Broadway came out in 2017, and I was a part of it.
The Go-Go's musical?
Yeah.
Did it last? Did it run?
It lasted 6 months on Broadway, and now it's like at 200, like high schools are doing it. It's really cool.
Oh, wow.
It's really cool. It's all over the country, like 200.
Do you make money off of that?
No.
Oh.
No, there's like so many investors that will get paid before I ever see it.
Right.
I mean, we made a little bit when it was on Broadway, because we were the composers.
Right.
It was all our music.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So that happened, and then this documentary got made that's going to be on Showtime, and it premiered at Sundance. That documentary has like opened up another level of like healing and just like really like kind of loving each other. It's a pretty amazing journey.
Is everyone around? Where are they?
I know everyone's spread out. Belinda's in Bangkok. Jane is in Mexico. Charlotte's here, and Gina's in San Francisco, and I'm in Texas.
Bangkok in Mexico?
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
For what reason?
They like to experience life in different places.
Okay.
Yeah, you know.
And what do you do when you go to the Continental?
I go see bands in Austin.
Do you play out there, though?
Yeah, I have a band in Austin called the Bluebonnets. You'd like it. It's a total rock and roll band. And the guitar player, Eve, she grew up with Gary Clark Jr., and he always acknowledges her.
Yeah.
And she's a great guitar player. And Dominique and I, she's the bass player and singer. We've had bands since like 1992. I'm always in a band. I'm always going to be in a band.
Yeah.
Whether the Go-Go's are the famous band
yeah.
and the successful band,
right.
but I don't care. I just want to be in a band, you know. So I play around Austin. We got gigs coming up, and it's a rock and roll band. It's all females, and it's
great.
You would love it.
I'm gonna come see you when I'm in Austin.
Okay, good.
Thank you for talking.
Thank you.
Do you feel like we covered enough?
This is awesome.
Thanks for doing it.
Yeah.
That was fun. I liked her. And that was, if you somehow just tuned into the middle, just started in the middle, that was Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's, her memoir, All I Ever Wanted. Comes out next Tuesday, March 31st. You can pre-order it now. The Go-Go's documentary premiered at Sundance in January. It will be on Showtime later this year. My special, End Times Fun, continues to be on Netflix, along with my other two specials, which I gather are getting a little juice because of the new one. I don't think Thinky Pain has been in the rotation in a while. I fucking did that years ago. But I think Thinky Pain, Too Real, also directed by Lynn Shelton, and the new one, End Times Fun, directed by Lynn Shelton, who's still here in the room. You can watch them all. And my buddy Tom Segura is on as well. Tom, I'm part of a cluster. Bert Kreischer, Hey Big Boy is on, and Ball Hog, Tom Segura's new one, is on. We are like some sort of weird quarantine cluster of stand-up specials. And now I'm going to play the guitar through a pedal, which I don't usually do.
Boomer lives.